Welcome to Blue Sky Banter, a conversation with legal luminaries about corporate governance, M&A, white-collar crime, and kindred topics. It's Wednesday, January 17th, and I'm Wren Holding, the editor of Columbia Law School's Blue Sky blog. Today, I'll be speaking with Judge Jed Rakoff of the U.S. District Court in Manhattan. The judge has had, as most of you know, a long and distinguished career as a federal prosecutor, a lawyer in private practice, and since 1996 on the bench, issuing high-profile rulings about everything from the death penalty to criminal sentencing to settlements involving big banks and Wall Street wrongdoers. Today, though, I want to speak with him about something very different. It's science and the law, and particularly neuroscience and the law. Welcome, Judge, and thanks so much for being here.
It's my pleasure, and thank you.
Now, the law is anything but a science, and yet, as you have pointed out, science can be an essential factor in many legal cases. What are some of the surprising ways in which it comes up?
Well, I think the biggest surprise, for me at least, has been how many different ways science comes into the courts and into judging, far more than I realized would be the case when I first went on the bench. So it comes up in forensic science, in criminal cases, it comes up in patent cases, it comes up through computerization in copyright and trademark cases, it comes up through civil rights cases and questions of civil commitment. It comes up all the time in sentencing through psychiatric testimony and medical testimony. It comes up in toxic torts through medical testimony and scientific testimony. I could go on and on.
Yeah, it's a very long list.
What I just didn't realize when I went on the bench was just how pervasive it really is.
Yeah. Now, you have been involved with science in a host of different ways. You teach a course at Columbia Law School on science and the law. You're on the governing board of the MacArthur Foundation's Law and Neuroscience Project. You co-edited the Judge's Guide to Neuroscience and on and on. And yet, as I understand it, you have no formal scientific background. How did this interest come to pass?
Well, it came about in three ways because, as you rightly say, I have no formal background. In fact, I was an English major and a history minor. So, like everyone else, I took the one required freshman course in science, and that was it.
Right.
My father was a doctor, so I did have some exposure, if you will, to science. And my middle daughter is a historian of medicine, so that also piqued my interest. But I would say the main way this came about was that I was approached early on in my judicial career by the MacArthur Foundation, and they said, we're setting up a program on law and neuroscience, would you like to get involved? And I said, well, I don't know a thing about neuroscience.
What brought them to you?
We were just at the same conference. It was something called the Grutter Institute.
Mm-hmm.
I said to them, I don't know anything about neuroscience, and they said, exactly, that's what we want. They put me on the board there, in effect, to say, you know, what do judges who know nothing about science need in the way of training in order to do their job in the great many instances, as I mentioned previously, where science gets into the legal system.
Yeah. Right. Now, I mean, as you point out, judges are generalists in the sense that they deal with a vast variety of topics. How How knowledgeable should we expect them to be about science, and how should they acquire that knowledge?
Well, I think that it's unrealistic to think that most people who are appointed to bench will come with any significant scientific training. There are exceptions, but they are really rare. I think to some extent the Federal Judicial Center for federal judges and similar organizations for state judges have begun to recognize they had to give training programs to judges in areas of science that are becoming significant in legal cases. But when all is said and done, I think the real obligation is on a judge, when he or she gets a case that involves science, to bone up on it, so to speak, I think that judges are becoming more and more aware that they have to do that, and so they will sometimes appoint special masters to help them out.
Right.
They will ask the lawyers to give them kind of a symposium for maybe a half day at the beginning of a case as to the science that's involved. They will read whatever are the treatises. And as you mentioned previously, the Federal Judicial Center has put out now the third edition of the Judge's Manual on Scientific Evidence, which I was fortunate enough to participate in the preparation of. And that gives you a sort of first cut at understanding virtually any science that will come into the courts. It's a multi-volume work, but what you do is you go and you look at the table of contents. Oh, yeah, there's a science that's going to be involved in my new case.
Right.
And that's the start. The good news is that judges were previously trial lawyers. Trial lawyers are quick studies. It is inherent in being an effective trial lawyer that you have to be a quick study.
Right.
And so I think judges are pretty good in getting into this stuff once they put their mind to it.
Right. Yeah. Well, and let's talk about a particular aspect of all this, and that's neuroscience and the law. And neuroscience, as I understand it, is concerned with the relationship between the mind and the body, the physical brain. And just briefly, why is that of special concern for the law?
So a great deal of the law is concerned with mental states. You cannot have normally a criminal conviction unless the defendant possessed what in the old days was called an evil mind, mens rea, and now goes by various synonyms like he did it willfully, he did it intentionally, but it refers to not the objective act that the defendant took, but the state of mind with which he took it. On the civil side, many, many torts have similar requirements, and indeed, whether or not a defendant will be held liable and for how much a defendant will be held liable is often directly a function of whether he acted with an intentional state of mind, with a reckless state of mind, or what. And determining what's in another person's mind is not easy.
Right.
It has always presented a problem for the legal system. Neuroscience has advanced tremendously in the last few decades because of the development of what's called fMRI. These are essentially giant magnets that can measure the blood flow, because blood has iron and therefore can be picked up by a magnet.
Right.
And you can now in some sense, see the mind at work.
Right.
So the exciting development has been, okay, now we can at least see the physical correlates of certain mental activities. That's a long way from saying that we fully can identify any given mental activity, and there's a danger that neuroscience will be hyped too quickly by lawyers and others who want to use it for their particular purposes.
And the problem is that you can see what the mind is doing, you just don't know what that means necessarily.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, for example, you can see that blood is flowing in a particular area of the mind more than it does when the mind in that area is at rest.
Right.
And that means that there is mental activity, because it's the oxygen from the blood that feeds that mental activity. But it doesn't follow from that 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 means that the mental activity is a lie or a pain or any of the other things that the legal system.
So how has that been useful? I mean, you can see what's happening, but we don't really know what that means. So what do we do with that?
So there is considerable hope that there will be indirect ways that we can get at some of the things we are interested in.
Right.
Pain is an example. If as some studies are beginning to show, chronic pain that goes on for months or years, actually leads to changes in parts of the brain. That, if it's validated to a reasonable degree of scientific validation,
right,
could be useful in cases where someone claims that as a result of an injury they suffered long-term pain, and the other side says, no, we don't think that really happened.
Right.
There's another example would be if someone says that they were at the scene of the crime and they saw X, Y, or Z, that will be recorded in some sense in their memory.
Hmm.
And though this is still at the very earliest stages, we're beginning to develop tests by which we can identify particular kinds of memories as opposed to other kinds of memories. And therefore, if once that gets to a degree of sophistication that it doesn't have now, but once it gets there,
right,
that would be very helpful to determine whether the guy is making it up or really did have that memory. Just to show the complications, though, people sometimes have false memories.
Right.
So it's not the mere fact that they say they have the memory, and there is embedded in their memory some correlate to that, doesn't mean they actually saw the crime.
Right.
It's complicated.
Yeah. And you mentioned false memories. That reminds me that over, really over the past, century or so, courts have sort of gotten ahead of themselves in using science in ways that have gotten them in trouble. Is that right? I mean, could you give us some of the highlights of how that's happened?
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think it's particularly true in what we would call the brain sciences in a very broad sense.
Right.
Because since the legal system is so interested in that area, there's always a temptation, science, which is so good and can produce such certainty when it's done right. We're dealing here with a very messy, uncertain legal system. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have something more certain? But that has led judges to sometimes be much too quick in accepting the science of the brain science of the moment that is often discredited. So to give a couple of examples,
right.
In the early 20th century, a science called eugenics was very, very popular with both scientists and non-scientists as well. And the theory of eugenics was that particular mental states, such as feeble-mindedness, are inherited, and that they are, we know enough about the genetics of how they are inherited that we can do away with it. And this led the courts to allow women to be, who were allegedly themselves feeble-minded, to be sterilized against their will.
Right.
And this, thousands of women were sterilized in the first decades of the 20th century, and no less a judge than Oliver Wendell Holmes, in writing an opinion for the Supreme Court called Buck v. Bell, bought into this and said,
right.
His famous phrase was, three generations of imbeciles is enough. and while that was, you know, a nice quip,
right.
What he was trying to convey was that he agreed that eugenics was good science.
Right.
Well, it turned out to be not good science. And people didn't really start to take a hard look at it until Adolf Hitler
right.
used eugenics for much of his racist philosophy. And then people began to take a harder look at it, and they found it was not good science at all.
Right.
But a lot of damage had been done before that occurred.
Right. And I think you've written about how psychiatry not that long ago was used in ways that were probably not justified. I think you've written about the renowned judge David Bazelon had some role in that. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, David Bazelon, very great judge. He was devoted to Freudian psychoanalysis, and he wrote a number of important opinions, of which the most important was called Durham, which said that no one could be convicted of a crime if the crime was the product of a mental disease or defect, because
mm-hmm.
they lacked the voluntariness necessary to hold them liable. He defined mental disease or defect in practice largely in terms of Freudian psychoanalysis. Well, Freud was a great man and contributed a great deal, but his psychoanalysis was not really scientifically tested in the way that most sciences are. And when eventually it was, it proved to be very less perfect than people had imagined. And Bazelon himself eventually denounced Freudian psychoanalysis as, quote, wizardry, meaning that it was just sort of like a cult. But he was probably a little bit overreacting to his own earlier conversion to that cult.
Right.
Freudian psychoanalysis and psychiatry generally was used and is still used, though not Freudism so much, but psychiatry, among other things, to commit people to mental hospitals for the rest of their life.
Right.
This is called civil commitment. And people who are said to be suffering from a mental disease or defect such that they are a danger to themselves or to others can be sent away to mental hospitals, which are really jails.
Right.
They have bars and guards and you can't leave. Until they are, quote, cured, and many times they can't be cured.
Right.
And the American Psychiatric Association has repeatedly said, we don't really think psychiatrists should be in this business because psychiatry is not yet at the stage where it can be that good at predicting things.
At predicting whether or not someone will be a danger to themselves or the public.
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, they did a specific survey in 1987 of whether psychiatrists could predict violence on the part of
right.
people who were suffering from one mental problem or another. And they found that psychiatrists were less than chance in predicting future violence.
Right.
And so they wrote to the Supreme Court. They filed what's called an amicus brief saying, you know, please don't force us to have to use this standard. But the Supreme Court said, too bad.
Yeah.
That's the standard.
Yeah.
And it is to this day.
And you've thought a lot about this. Is what's your view of that standard? I mean, I guess.
I think the standard is neither psychiatrically sound nor workable, and I think it leads to many cases of people being in effect imprisoned when they haven't committed any crime at all.
Yeah.
I think that most psychiatrists will tell you that they would rather go back to a much earlier standard, which was basically, does this person, can they act in a rational way or not?
Right.
But that was the kind of standard that was debunked in cases like Durham.
Right. Well, and it doesn't, and it's so, such a broad and sort of indefinite standard. It's
And
you, I imagine, on the bench have dealt, I mean, you've had to apply the standard in cases, or have you found ways to avoid it, or how have you dealt with it?
Well, the most interesting case I had was a case in which a former governor of the state of New York said that by administrative rule, decreed that people who had been convicted criminally of offenses involving sexual, not necessarily violence, but sexual aspects.
Right.
Anything from very serious matters like rape to much less violent matters like child pornography, still very
right.
serious, but of a different kind. That those people, within a week before they finally had finished serving their prison terms, would be examined by two state psychiatrists, and
mm-hmm.
both psychiatrists agreed that they were a danger to themselves or the community, they would be sent to a mental hospital, confined in a mental hospital, and could only then challenge the ruling, which is extremely difficult to do once
you're right.
in a hospital. I held that law unconstitutional, and the Court of Appeals affirmed
right.
my decision. But what was there was an interesting footnote, which was six of the people who had been confined for a substantial period then brought a lawsuit, and the jury proved to be very unsympathetic to them, because they, when they took the stand, they were not everyday folks. So
right.
They clearly had mental issues, and
right.
yet they had never committed any further crime. They
mm-hmm.
had served their time completely. Some of them had served
mm-hmm.
10, 15, 20 years. Now they are a week before they're finally ready to get out. They've done nothing else. They've committed no further bad act.
Yeah.
And suddenly they're sent off to be, in effect, in prison for the rest of their life.
And that lawsuit was unsuccessful, I take it.
So, well, I mean, it was successful in the first part because I held the law unconstitutional. But the follow-up, which was, okay, we
right.
were entitled to damages,
right.
to money, because we were held for several years under this unconstitutional procedure. The jury awarded, if I remember correctly, they awarded a grand total of $1.
Amazing.
Because they just were unsympathetic to,
right,
to these particular people. So it sort of, to my mind, it sort of illustrated the depths of the problem.
Right. Can you think of any cases, any of your cases in which neuroscience has come up, in which you have used or in some way used the concepts of neuroscience in reaching either a decision or a sentence or any kind of...
Yeah, I think it comes up most often in sentencing, at least in my experience,
right,
in my court. An example was a case I had a few years ago where the defendant had pled guilty to a very substantial financial fraud, but he said that the reason he had committed this fraud was a gambling addiction.
Right.
And there was a real question. It's not just a neuroscience question. It's also a more general psychiatric question of whether gambling addiction is for real or just, a lawyer's construct to try to get the guy a lesser sentence. So
right.
I held a lengthy hearing, and I determined that it is for real. It's not a total excuse. I didn't give the guy probation. I still gave him some prison time, but it mitigated because he was not acting with a full deck, so to speak. And a good example of that from that very case was he at one point had bet all his clients millions of dollars on a particular stock trade, and he had hit. He was successful, and at that moment in time, he could have repaid
right.
Everyone all the money he owed them. Instead, within a couple of days, he bet all the money he had just made
right.
on another risky bet, and that one he lost.
Yeah.
And that was what led to his downfall.
Yeah.
There was an element of that. It wasn't the whole story, but there was an element of compulsion. Not being able to fully act in a rational, responsible
right.
way, even though he was in the rest of his life a totally
right. And that condition, that it's not a handicap, but that that condition.
It's like a disability. Yes.
Yeah, I was going to try to avoid the word disability, but okay, that disability. it's. That's a factor. I mean, I can understand how that's a factor in sentencing. That's not a factor in the culpability of the defendant. That's not a factor in his mens rea, in his liability.
That's correct. Unless he is totally insane.
Yeah.
If you were really insane, then that is a total defense.
Right.
But that, in my 21 years on the bench, I've seen an insanity defense grand total of once. It's a very high standard and very
sure.
very rare.
Yeah,
and it is a relevant factor that these lesser problems are very real problems nonetheless. Are a factor that a judge can take into account in sentence. And the problem I had in this case was I wasn't sure whether this was a real factor or just a phony excuse, and that's why I had to hold the hearing.
And how did you reach your conclusion? I imagine you had experts.
I did.
Talking.
I had experts on both sides. But the defense called a terrific expert, and the government called a terrific expert, and so I had to evaluate. As is often the case. With really good experts, they agreed on more than they disagreed on.
Right.
But these were not hired guns. Another
right.
problem that with experts, although this is less so in scientific experts and more often in other areas, some of them are just hired guns who will say almost anything. And that makes it very difficult for a judge or jury to assess. But when you have real experts, people whose lives are spent as scientists, but who agree not as a business, but just as a sometime thing, to testify in a case of some interest to them or one that they know someone or something of that sort, then you can get some very useful information, but you still need to evaluate it. And how do you ultimately evaluate it? I guess when all is said and done, you evaluate it against the facts of the case.
Right.
And did the actions of the defendant, the actual acts that he took, were those consistent with how he operated in his everyday, non-problematic, more or less voluntary, more or less rational way, or were they aberrational? Did they reflect something that he seemingly had no control over or very little control over? The facts provide the test.
Right. And how much of your own knowledge do you think went into your decision? I mean, you came to the case with at least for a judge, a fairly substantial background in terms of thinking about these issues. Do you think it would have been useful, that hearing would have been as useful, if you hadn't come to it with your kinds of experience?
Well, I mean, I like to think that even judges can learn from experience. So I think I would have conducted a less able hearing, a less useful hearing 20 years ago than I did
right
when I did this. So sure, it's you the more you do it, the better you get at it.
Right.
One real problem is because judges are not scientists, they will sometimes try to avoid these issues, and they'll say, well, I'll decide this case on some technical ground,
right,
rather than reach the issue, because, gee, I'm not a scientist, what do I know? And I think that's a great mistake, because then the next time they will go the same route. It's only after they more or less see that they've got to get into science a little bit and begin to understand it and begin to get familiar with it, that they can do their job.
Well, and it's interesting. I mean, I imagine once you start learning about it, you want to learn more.
Oh, definitely. It is fascinating stuff. As I mentioned, science is everywhere these days.
Right.
And certainly everywhere in the law.
Right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Judge Rakoff, I want to thank you again for being with us. And listeners, join me again soon for another edition of Blue Sky Banter.
Thanks so much.
That's it. Thanks.
Bye-bye.